This is The Conversation. It's episode 179 with Lisi Raskin. She is a Providence, Rhode Island-based artist and the head of sculpture at RISD, a.k.a. Rhode Island School of Design, which also does art. And yeah, it's an intense one. More on that in a second. I am Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com. where you can go check out images of Lisi's installations, performances with her band Upheavals, collaborations, etc. And yeah, so go check those out. You can also write a nice review on iTunes and you can support the show financially there as well. So the conversation with Lisi, I definitely got pushed out of my comfort zone, which is a good thing every once in a while. I do say at one point that when we're addressing that particular issue, that it's usually so easy, I say. But in fact, that's actually not true. It's never easy. Sometimes it's I'm a little more in the zone than others. But for this one, it just required a lot of intense focus. And part of me had to sort of go into overdrive, overpilot. And there's so many things that I feel like, as I often do after recording, that I could continue to address. And one of them in this case is the P word. If you listened to the episode with Jennifer Dalton about five episodes back, we had a conversation about the P word, which you may have found interesting. This time it became more of a debate. And so you have that to look forward to. I think, however, that said, that this may be the last conversation that I have about that word. I'm just going to, I think, forbid it in the future. Just make that clear. So enjoy it the last time you get to hear it, all that to say. But all that said as well, I think you'll find it a very inspiring conversation from academias, from somebody in academia who knows the ropes of academia and has been steeped in it since her days at Columbia, 2001. And there's a lot about gentrification, which she raises to a whole new level in terms of responsible gentrification, which I think you'll find interesting as well. And one other thing on the back end, I am going to give you a heads up on an article that I think will be very helpful to many of you on how to get out of the cycle of outrage that many of us are feeling right now. So just a heads up. In the meantime, let's get to that conversation with Lisi Raskin right now. And I will talk to you more on the back end. Enjoy. So you are in Providence, as we have covered, and you're there because you have a job at Rhode Island School of Design, correct?
Correct. And I run the sculpture department.
You run the sculpture department, and I can't recall from our last conversation if that's something that's just starting this winter, or if you started back in the fall.
I started in the fall, but I mean, my contract started in the summer, so I've effectively been working since July.
Got it. Okay. So is that pretty unusual that one comes to a new school, especially a pretty well-known big school, and runs the department as opposed to being, rising from within?
I mean, there are schools that do that. And I think it's a new model for leadership at RISD.
I see.
Yeah.
Got it. I'm wondering how much I should ask you about, what it was about the application process and, what was it that appealed to them particularly about you. But maybe we'll come to that organically, if at all. But you were, before being at RISD, you were teaching at Tyler. Is that right?
Absolutely,
which
correct.
Which is in Philadelphia, and you were commuting from New York, where you lived for a while, right?
So I had my apartment in New York, but I moved my studio actually to Philly, and then rented a room with some friends. So I was in both places, but I think it's more people can understand what commuting means, so I just use that as shorthand.
Oh, well, so in other words, you were really more like full-time in Philadelphia, but you kept a place in New York just in case you needed to go back and kind of to keep an address there and that kind of thing?
No, I mean, I was where I needed to be. And I didn't tend to keep track of it in terms of a bigger picture. I just kind of went where I needed to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, why did you need to be in New York? In other words, where did you have show? Was it shows, that kind of thing? So you had a job that where you needed to be in Philadelphia. What were the things that made you need to be on any given occasion in New York?
I mean, maybe it's a combination between need and want, because I had been living in New York. I moved to New York in 2001 to go to graduate school, and had several galleries there over the years and, you know, numerous shows there over the years. So it could be a combination of wanting to catch up with friends, you know, going to an opening, you know, like being with family, having a meeting, wanting to go to an event.
Right.
Any of that stuff. Or just hang out. It was I really liked my neighborhood. I really liked to lay low in Brooklyn and, you know, just sort of have some quiet time.
What was your neighborhood in Brooklyn?
Brooklyn Heights.
That's pretty fancy.
Super fancy.
we need to talk about this. So you're now in Providence, right? And did you give up your place in whatever place you had in New York?
I did. I mean, I was the tenant of my aunt and uncle.
Mm.
And so now the apartment is being occupied by their daughter.
Oh, okay.
So it was kind of, yeah, I mean, they were kind of my patrons for really the early part of my career. I'm not sure it would have been possible for me to be a New York-based artist and travel internationally and exhibit way that I did had it not been for their support,
right?
Which was amazing.
Yeah. So in other words, you basically got their patronage by having this place to live in what happens to be one of the fancier Brooklyn neighborhoods.
I had a huge rent subsidy. I had their lawyers. I had their help looking over contracts. They're incredibly good with their bureaucratic function is exceptional.
Mm.
So I had really solid adults to ask business questions to and to do long-term planning and things like that. They're incredible people. They were incredibly generous.
Okay. So in other words, in addition to having the place, they were also giving you professional advice on a lot of your decision-making as far as residencies, shows, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, I'm not sure that they understood my field to give that sort of advice. But for example, contract negotiation, which I think is an area where a lot of artists, they don't read what they sign.
Right.
Or at least I'm told, usually, I'm the first person that's ever wanted to make an amendment to a number or line in a contract.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. That's something that's come up before, but I'm really interested in the Brooklyn Heights thing because as you, to some small degree, if not more, may be aware, I like the conversation around gentrification. It's always a good place to start anyway. So I'm picturing you being in Brooklyn Heights, you know, an artist living in Brooklyn Heights, which is an outsider like myself would argue perhaps the fanciest neighborhood in Brooklyn. Certainly the oldest, fanciest, whereas maybe a place like Williamsburg is maybe the newest, fanciest. But you're in a neighborhood where the demographic is very different than you, right? You know, because artists are in Bushwick or, you know, maybe further out as the 2000s turned into the 2010s and so on. To what extent were you aware of that? You know, of being sort of a stranger in a strange land or any of that kind of thing?
I mean, I guess I didn't feel like I was a stranger in a strange land, you know, because it was an affluent environment full of people that had Ivy League pedigrees. So, I mean, I also am one of those people. I mean, I come from a very privileged background.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's actually very important to describe that, because I think that a lot of times people don't understand what staying power means in the art world and how you gain access. And a lot of that has to do with either a capacity to generate capital or family money or
yeah.
both.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah.
I'm so glad you're saying that. And you already alluded to it by mentioning the apartment situation. Because as in fact, I did talk about, I think Jennifer Dalton, an artist who I had on a few episodes ago, and I enjoyed this this metaphor, you know, the oil running underground as a way of describing how a lot of artists are surviving or thriving. You know, it's because there are these sustaining aspects, you know, of their life. And you just articulated that really well, that it helps to come from affluence to stay in affluence in a sense. I guess, you know, but maybe with another way of looking at it is, even if you, as you put it, were in a environment where people were in your same class or what have you, you still were an artist. I don't know, you know, I can't imagine that there were a lot of working artists that were, especially younger working artists that were living in Brooklyn Heights when you were there.
No, it wasn't exactly the place where we would convene. I mean, I'd invite people over.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
Right, right. And the process of getting the job at RISD, was that pretty complicated?
No. I mean, I'm not sure how much you know about the procedure of academic hiring, but maybe if listeners don't know, I can just go into it a tiny bit.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So there's basically a season for it. You know, you start to see job listings post like around October, November, and then there's a time, sort of like deadline around December, January, February, and then applications are closed. And then, you know, February, March, you begin to hear about whether or not you're a finalist, and then there are interviews. And usually by April, May, you've been notified as to whether you've received the job or they make you an offer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's basically the trajectory of that.
Right.
And I guess I've done it probably about five separate times, over the years. You get to put your cover letter together, you get your recommenders down, you sort of do a little bit of research and, you know, you hope for the best.
Yeah. So you went to Columbia, and I'm wondering, for grad school, and I'm wondering to what extent you were getting into teaching like right out of that program.
Oh, they were fantastic about that. Mm-hmm. During school, I was a teaching assistant for John Kessler, and he did something phenomenal, which was to allow me to create an assignment and mm-hmm. sort of and lead the class through it.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually they hired me the following year that I graduated to teach an intro to sculpture class. And then they had me back, and periodically still have me back, but they had me back to teach a group critique class and do individual studio visits. All of those things as income streams, but also as lines on my CV were incredibly important for giving me credentials that would be attractive to people who are evaluating me.
Right, yeah. So people talk about, you know, there are these occasional dialogues, is grad school worth it? Is it worth it going to going into debt to go to X school, you know, when you could go to this other school that's public or what have you? You just articulated, whether you're intending to or not, going to a school where the investment is very real. You know, that it really, in your case, and I don't know how common or rare that is, that you went to a school that started building your teaching career as well as your art career.
Yeah, I mean, it did. Although I should mention that I'm still paying for it. So
sure.
I graduated in 2003.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So I think it's sort of, it's interesting, though, to be like, is it worth it? And then we lump it into the dollar as though that's the, you know, I think it's not the only way to evaluate it, as you've articulated.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
but you may still very well be paying for it, you know, 14 years later. But people who went to, you know, the fictional equivalent of somebody who went to a public school where they drifted and, you know, and were not able to get teaching jobs or got adjunct jobs here and there or what have you, any one of those kinds of scenarios, you know, where 10, 15 years later, they are not in a tenure track position, you know, and they are not able to, you know, have that solid foundation or that stability that is very, it seems to me, very easily counteracts whatever kind of loans or debt from being in school there was.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the more that someone knows about what they want their outcomes to be, the more they can sort of plan for the kind of graduate program that's going to be best for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think I really didn't know, and I think I really liked the vibe at Columbia. I really liked John Kessler. I showed up there and serendipitously met the two students that were on, that were the student participants of the admissions committee, had fantastic conversations with them, and just really had an incredible time. But it was also like 2001 to 2003 in New York, which I couldn't say, like, I couldn't really take the temperature now and understand whether or not those circumstances are reproducible, but I suspect they're not.
Mm-hmm. In what way? In other words, that was a great time to be in New York, or?
Well, I think that it was a complicated time to be in New York because the Trade Towers, of course, like, got hit by an airplane, and then there was all, you know, George W. Bush's presidency, but the there was an uptick in politicized subject matter and conversations, and a real feeling of like intellectual and political alignment and solidarity, like around the school. And then at the same time, there was like, you know, it was boom time, and, you know, gallerists and critics were coming to open studios, and it seemed like there was a buzz around the school. And so it was a lot was happening simultaneously. And I think, you know, financially, New York was in a different situation. I think job prospects for artists, or like viable, the prospect of like anything being viable was different then.
Mm-hmm.
It was boom time.
Yeah. Yeah. That I think despite, you know, that it was a difficult time, you know, in the bigger sense, it ultimately was still a financially very strong time. So despite the brief downturn, you know, for what it was. But you mentioned a couple of things that I wanted to go referred back to. One was that, you know, you didn't know what you wanted. And I'm glad you said that, because, you know, when you went into grad school, because I don't think most people do. I don't think most people go, this is what, you know, I should correct myself. Maybe some people who finish undergrad or, you know, or art school and then are out of school for 10 years and then they go to grad school. Maybe those people are much more clear about what they want. But a lot of people don't go into art school / grad school with a clear understanding of exactly, you know, how they want things to go. I mean, most of them, I would hazard a guess, just want to become professional artists. But as far as having more of a sense of the details and complications and percentages, I don't think many do. And what was the other thing that you said that stuck? Oh, you mentioned the serendipity as well. And I think, yeah, it sounds like you had some very good timing and wound up choosing place. I don't know how consciously that had a lot going for it and just made all the difference, you know, where going to another school, you wouldn't have had those kinds of, one would not have had those kinds of things, those kinds of people.
It felt so vital.
Mm-hmm.
It was
right.
A vital place. And I think about it a lot as we're, Heather Rowe, who's my colleague at RISD, the graduate program director, as she and I are sort of like visioning the next, you know, 5 years of RISD Sculpture MFA. Mm-hmm. She also went to Columbia, and we think a lot about what that experience was like. Right. And I think, you know, I caught it at a moment where, you know, John was putting a lot of energy into it. We had, I mean, Carol Walker, Dana Hoey, Rick Chiravanija. I mean, Coco Fusco. I took critical theory with Coco Fusco. I took anthropology in the War Machine with Michael Taussig. I mean, it was just sort of like, you know, you could take an art history class with Rosalind Krauss. I mean, you know, it was just like, there was a lot there. And I think there was a lot of just excitement around it. And they plugged it in. They brought in people. I met Lynn Cook. I met Ronnie Horn. I met Collier Shore. I met Matt Mullican. And then they orchestrated it in a way that you had repeat contact with these people. And it's sort of like, you know, that was a lot of access.
Mm, yeah. Are Columbia people, Columbia alumni, dominating the teaching field, do you think?
I mean, we teach.
So yes, I mean, that's another answer for yes. Well,
I mean,
you
I
just
think it's
mentioned
sort of
your
like
colleague.
there are passionate educators like in my cohort, in like the direct cohort, like the one my cohort, and then the ones, you know, that were below me a year and above me a year, right? Like there are some really passionate, dedicated educators.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible.
Mm.
Who are amazing artists. So yeah.
Yeah, and that's actually a really important point, because those two things are often mutually exclusive, you know, or they're not mutually inclusive. Let's just put it that way, because dedicated, great artists can often be horrible teachers, is what I'm trying to say. You know, to have both, a really good artist who's a dedicated teacher, is, you know, is not a common thing. I mean, I have this, and I'll just say one more thing about it, and then you can let me know what your response is, but. One of my pet peeves is artists who are having really big careers. You could call them great artists, maybe. That's not really the point, but they are having these great careers, and then they have this sort of tenured or full-time teaching job at a school where, you know, they're there because the school wants to sell them to potential students, you know, and so their presence there is for their reputation, but their dedication and commitment, it does not necessarily follow.
I see. I know what you're talking about, but my experience has been the opposite, which
mm-hmm.
is that
mm-hmm.
I've had the privilege to study with people who understand that mentoring and educating the next generation of artists is requires their vision, which is much larger. Or is inclusive of, so it's a yes and. I mean, someone like Carol Walker is a visionary. Someone like Coco Fusco is a visionary.
Mm-hmm.
And those two artists understood what their public practices were, how they faced the world, what their writing practices were, and what their teaching and mentoring practices, you know, are and continue to be. So I think in that situation, I had like fantastic role models. I mean, John Kessler as well. I mean, he's someone who really understood that, how to build a program, how to nurture young artists, how to create and generate excitement. And, you know, he's one of my favorite artists. So it's like you've got three people in my top three. If I had to be like, okay, I'm building like a team of the best artist educator visionaries.
Right.
And I had exposure, you know, to all three of them. And, you know, so in thinking about like the kind of people, for example, that I want to hire, or the kind of people that I had the privilege to go to school with who end up being those people, I'm thinking of someone like Mark Handelman, who teaches at Rutgers, who has been like one of my most important artistic dialogues for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we met in graduate school, and I learned by teaching next to him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mm-hmm. and my practice grew through his challenging questions.
Right.
So I think, yeah, it's,
So you've used one of my least favorite words, practice, quite a number of times in the last couple of minutes, and I guess I just want to, without giving you too hard a time about it, I'm curious, when you were in Colombia, if that was a word that was used a lot.
I mean, probably, but I think that I like to distinguish it. You
mm-hmm.
know, like practice can happen and can mean your work in the studio. It can mean your work in institutions. It can mean your work in institutions of higher education, your work in community, any of those kinds of things where this is all a process.
Right.
Making art is a process. You're never finished with it, so you're always practicing. It's kind of like hitting tennis balls against the wall,
mm-hmm.
but just in as many different applications as you see fit. But I am aware of the cliche connotation that you're talking about. But
yeah.
I think I am practicing being the best teacher I possibly can, being the best
mm-hmm.
artist I possibly can, being like the most, you know, like curious, you know, like intellectual that I can possibly muster being. I think all those things I'm constantly refining.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand like why it gets tired.
Yeah.
Because I think it's tired when it's meaningless jargon.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? But if we can
right.
impregnate or sort of fill that word with some meaning and purpose.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's also more applicable in your case because of the dialogue with you know, students with colleagues and so on, you know, that it is much more of a process, whereas I think people tend to overapply it in the more professional context of art making, where it really is not a practice because it's a product, you know, and not necessarily in the most cynical way, just it's, you know, yeah, it's getting better and it's evolving, but it's not like, there's something about the word practice that makes it sound like when you're practicing, you know, tennis hitting or what have you, like you're trying to get better, but that's really not what you're trying to do. You're just trying to do what you're trying to do. That's a byproduct of what you're doing. I don't know if we're getting too in the weeds here, but that's just kind of one of the things that kind of bugs me about, you know, when that word practice is as if you are, you know, you're going to your studio to do something on your own that you're trying out, like you're trying a magic trick or something. You know, it's not, I just don't buy that analogy.
Do you make art?
I do.
So you feel like you go in and you know what you're doing?
No,
studio,
no,
or?
I don't. I just don't feel like I'm practicing it. I feel like I'm doing it.
Okay.
Go ahead. You know, make your counter argument.
Oh, I think I did. I mean, when I talk to you about like the way that the word practice is meaningful to me, mm-hmm. but I understand the way that it's an irritant.
Yeah.
To you, but I think though any word where we're using it as jargon and we don't actually think about the way that the terms apply to us or don't apply to us.
Right.
I think it's when we slip into that mode of like unconscious, reproduction of just blather, then it's like really irritating.
Well, you mentioned, you asked me about, you know, do I know what I'm doing? Do you know it? Don't you know what you're doing? I mean, to what extent do you not know what you're doing when you're in the studio?
I mean, to every extent I possibly can not know. Like, I think I usually just form a basic set of rules so that I can then break them. I mean, I never know how I've made the thing that I've just completed. And it's actually funny because people will say to me, well, how did you do this? And what did you do first? And I'll look at the object and honestly, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think like, but I think though that there are pressures that, conditions put on artists to know and to sort of go to the studio, and I just call it kind of like making the donuts. Like you got your recipe and you put it out there and you stay within, you know, kind of like a narrowly defined area. And I think, you know, I don't necessarily do that. Like I willingly and willfully like disregard any of the things that I could do to like repeat myself consciously so that I can get through the task quickly in order to yield an art object.
Mm-hmm.
So, I like to be confused and make mistakes.
Okay.
And fail.
Right. Okay. So you're really
repeatedly.
Yeah. You're really emphasizing a situation in which you embrace not knowing what you're doing, being in a place where you're at sea in a sense.
Yes. I mean, also I get bored if I know too much.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think
I'm always trying to learn as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think perhaps a bigger picture of that approach is that having a teaching gig is sort of instrumental in that equation, because if you're, well, at least compared to making objects, you know, for the market, because in that situation, I would, for the most part, people don't have the freedom to fail, to experiment, to not know what they're doing, and so on.
Wait, in which situation don't people have the luxury to fail?
In the object, you know, in the donut making that you, your metaphor earlier, the donut making scenario.
Oh, I think that they create this condition, you know, and I think that they sort of, you know, people who are explicitly making things, let's say something hits and they don't change it because all of a sudden they've got a mortgage and they've got, a responsibility and they can't really change it. And if they do change it, then they don't have an income stream.
Yeah. Right.
So right. I think at a certain point I demonetized my art practice by like getting a job, and I've never been happier.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was talking about. I was talking about the demonetizing, and you know, and I don't think it's as simple as being afraid to change up the formula, you know, because one has the mortgage and so on. I think it's hard a lot of times for people to, and I think I understand it too, for it, that it's hard for people to go into much more of a failure and experimentally embracing situation that you're referring to, because I think there is a desire to perfect or to see a certain kind of sensibility, a certain kind of vision, which is maybe very different from the visionary word that you used earlier, but to see a certain vision reach its kind of logical conclusion. And that might involve a situation in which the work changes very gradually, you know, like a little alteration is made after a year or something like that, or a couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are tremendous pressures that are imposed on us, and we continue to impose on ourselves, just based on the ideology of this culture.
Mm. What do you mean by that? The ideology of this culture?
Oh, I mean, you know, like a enlightenment notion of the individual, the artist, genius, the self, and then the way that capitalism really ratchets that up a few more extreme notches. To monetize genius and the individual and the artist, and you know, including things like fame and notions of, I mean, just like, it just gets too important, the individual, the self, you know, what your work's about, you know,
right,
as a thing, it just becomes, you know, too much of a focal point.
Yeah. And that reminds me that with some of, and I don't know, maybe some of is not strong enough a word, maybe with a lot of your work, you collaborate, or you have sort of it becomes a non-hierarchical, is the way you put it, type of situation. Is that, how important is that? I mean, because you did describe just a little earlier, you know, being in the studio and creating these sets of problems and so on, and that's all you. But to what extent, when you're working on projects, is it a shared situation?
Well, I think it varies, and I would say maybe a goal would be non-hierarchical, but probably what's more practical is to sit with a group of people and look at the situation and address the hierarchies that exist, and then figure out how we can tinker with that situation to form a more equitable exchange.
Right. Is there an example that comes to mind where you're trying to address the hierarchy and to make it more equitable?
Sure. I mean, so I'm part of a rock band called The Peebles, and I, you know, wanted to collaborate with a group of students after a particularly good semester of advanced painting. So I am, you know, in my mid-career, and I'm a professor, their professor, and I asked them to collaborate with me, and I want to form this thing, and we have to negotiate where I am in my life, the access I have versus where they are in their life and the access that they have. I need to understand, and we need to address in a very realistic way, the fact that there are power dynamics at play, the fact that there's projection at play. And we're constantly negotiating the fact that whenever we get any press or notoriety, you know, the system that we're living in, the media, let's say art media or whatever it is, let's say marketing media, wants to consolidate this notion into a singular member. And a lot of times it's been me. So then people will say it's Lisi's rock band. It's not my rock band. Like they are really the musical engine, you know, behind it. We all play our different parts. But I think that whole thing, looking at a situation, really taking it apart and responding in a way when different projections come at you, and having that be part of the substance of the conversation of the group, like that can be a path toward a more equitable situation. We also have different subject positions. You know, like, I'm a white Jewish lesbian. You know, there's, like, new Americans in there. There's brown folks. There's, like, queers. There's cis, you know, heterosexual people. I mean, it's sort of like everybody's got privileges. Everybody's got, you know, ways that they're subjugated by our culture. And it's just sort of like, you know, some people have money, some people don't have money, some people have jobs, some people are underemployed. And so it's like this whole thing, it's like all those things, that's what we address when we're like, all right, what's really going on here? What are we making music about? What's at play here? Whose connections are we going to use? You know, that sort of stuff.
Right. Is there a comparable scenario, though, that maybe is a little closer to your art making? I mean, because that, I mean, I know you could sort of describe that as an extension of your art, but it feels like a separate entity. I don't know if, you know, if that bothers you, my distinction, but if Lisi is having a show, you know, at any given space, is there a situation in which that has become a group of people? I mean, maybe that's a completely different scenario, but I guess that's kind of what I'm picturing.
Well, I want to address like the response you have that it feels like a side thing or an offshoot of, right? Because I think that perspective speaks very much to what I'm talking about, which is that we look at someone and we can imagine that they do one thing and they're known for that thing. Mm-hmm. And that's the most important thing.
Right.
And I think like when I began to realize that my teaching practice supported the work I was making in the studio and that I would go and make, you know, large scale installations and that people were helping me. And a lot of times the labor politics in those situations are inequitable. Like I began to have more and more of a realization about what was supporting the making of my work in its various iterations. And I think over the years, even though this doesn't necessarily reflect the way that our culture understands it, but I personally have become less interested in what I call LisiRaskin.com. Mm. So that is like the notion of me as an individual that is engaged in a set of ideas that are assumed to originate in me entirely based on my response to the world or some such nonsense. Like, I am standing on the shoulders of so many people, and I'm supported by so many people. So I think now I'm really interested in, well, how can I use this, you know, the access that LisiRaskin.com gets to redistribute, you know, the opportunity and to do like, and to learn together. And yeah, it's great. If the outcome is an artwork, that's awesome. If it's an album, awesome. If it's a curriculum, amazing. So I think what I want to do is like decentralize the experience of the individual that we call Lisi Raskin.
Right, right. Yeah. So a situation might be if it's an art context. Not that, you know, I want to sort of beat down, break down these different categories. But if let's just say if it's that one, you might have an opportunity to have a show in an institution of some kind, and it becomes a collaborative situation in which through the process of which you empower these other people to have had that experience.
Well, the large scale installations like are by virtue of like me being my age with this body, no longer things I can do by myself.
Right.
So, you know, for the last 15 of them or so, I've relied really heavily on the assistance of other people. Just like sheer labor, we got drills, we're cutting things. Two summers ago at in Krakow, Poland, at Bunker Stuki, I finally took hold of that equation and was like, all right, like, let me really do this. Okay, so I had a group of assistants who were hired by the institution. And I met with them every morning at 10 for coffee, and then we'd go into the institution and make paintings. And I set up the constraints. So I was like, this is the palette, here are the materials, and all that sort of stuff. And then we just played. And we made this thing, and, you know, I'm really quite proud of it. And then when it got time to deal with how we were all being paid, we sat down and had another conversation and redistributed the fees. Because it wasn't equitable. And when it came time to name whose name like would go on this artwork, we decided that, and really they decided, because I would have just been like, it's ours and everybody's name goes on it. But they wanted me to be the front person and then have their names with or parenthetically.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bunker Stookey collected it. So that was, they acquired it. And so it was like one of those moments where we were able to talk about authorship and ownership and distribution of capital. And we were able to redistribute capital so that it felt more equitable. And so that people were able to do things like go on vacation or like buy their groceries. So it was sort of like, but that was a situation where I feel like the project was firing on all cylinders.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that I was necessarily there as empowering them. It was like, I said, listen, I don't want to have you get my coffee and like, you know, go run errands for me. I want to know who you are. And if that's cool, I'd like you to know who I am. And so we, you know, we hung out. It's not like, you know, I got to know them and like what they were concerned about and what they saw when they thought of things and their sense of humor. And, you know, we traveled around a little bit together and, you know, we went to Auschwitz. It was deep. It wasn't like they were my employees. We were all being paid by the institution to work on this project. So, I mean, that I think is an example of what is possible. Hopefully I will get even better at doing that so that more incredible things can become possible. And then there are new models for how to interact. And then, you know, we talk about them and people feel like they can, might feel like they can take it up as their work as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you shared that because that's exactly the kind of thing that I was hoping to get at and that, you know, that you had in mind because, and as you were describing that anecdote, that show, I was thinking about all the artists who, you know, it's a big deal when they like mention the assistants, you know, who help them work on their show. But it's usually anonymous assistants, you know, who are at least have that job, which, you know, it, to whatever degree is a good thing for them. But ultimately, you know, they're kind of just part of the machine. But for you to be so thoughtful about the roles that these people play, I think is great. Were these people just out of curiosity coming over with you, or were they all in Europe?
Oh, I tried to get the curator to bring the advanced painting class, who are now my bandmates from the States, but they said no, we're gonna find you a group of like young artists, as they termed, that were based in Krakow.
Mm-hmm.
And they were students at the art academy, and you know, we're excited to be, you know, working at Bunker Stookey. It was a museum they'd grown up going to. And just were, you know, incredibly open. So they were locals.
It seems like
which is also helpful because
yeah.
I don't speak Polish.
It seems better to me. I don't know how much you thought about it, but even though you wanted to have your advanced painting students over, it seems better to me that you would work with and collaborate with local people. But you know, because for an artist to bring it seems less ideal to me for an artist to bring their posse, however, you know, sort of hierarchical, you know, giant studio assistance type situation, or more socialist, like the kind of situation you're describing. To work with the locals when you're working in another country just seems like a better way to go.
Well, I think it's helpful because, you know, you can get the lay of the land and you know where the good, you know, good restaurants are and the deli and the grocery store and what you can and can't do on the street. But there is also a model that I was trying to make an intervention into, which is one that allows for like more of a durational relationship with a group of people. So I think like a lot of times in my experience, I've been, you know, invited someplace, you know, another country. I get to go to participate in an international biennial or a show or whatever. And I sort of like drop in, I hang out for 2 or 3 weeks and then I leave. And I may have formed relationships with people that were based on the necessity to produce the work. But after that, it's hard to know how anybody's doing and to know if there's any real impact. And I think similarly, you know, in the category of community arts, that's like the durational is what's necessary for artists who are going to invest in a local situation. with people that they have ongoing relationships with and can act as a community member mm-hmm. and a mentor and sort of an elder or a guide or a teacher, what have you. And I think we're missing that a little bit in this sort of itinerant model of traveling and art making. So I long for that. So I've been trying to produce that, but it was absolutely great to work with them in Krakow. I mean, you know, Magda, Kasia, Władek were unbelievably wonderful.
Mm.
So it was a win-win.
Right. I can't help but wonder about the, when you're describing the process that you've had going into these places, you know, for a couple of weeks or whatever, and putting up these show, and you mentioned earlier, you know, that you're less interested in, is what you said, in, you know, this entity, Lizzie Raskin, that is LizzieRaskin.com. But I'm trying to figure out how you reconcile those two kind of extremes or those two things. You know, you ultimately are getting those gigs because of who you are, you know, and then so maybe you're, as you described in that Warsaw situation, you know, you're then getting to improvise or you know, work, collaborate, you know, in that situation. But do you see what I'm getting at? I guess you take the opportunity, being who you are and having the pull that you have, and then you go in and you try to mess with the conceit a bit. Is that kind of
well?
Fair?
I mean, I think it, mm-hmm. it brings up like a really interesting and like topical, like, and profound set of questions for now,
mm-hmm.
which is, what do you do with your privilege?
Right.
If you're willing to acknowledge that you have it and step into your power.
Right.
If I have access to capital and opportunities, and I want to redistribute capital and opportunities, can that function as a model?
Yeah.
So I think it's sort of like, and I think I really struggled with, how was I going to best use the opportunities that were afforded me?
Mm-hmm.
Because I had many of them, and there were many times that I was like, I don't know if I really got all that I needed to get out of this, and I don't know that I really put all that I needed to put into it. And I think it's just now, in the last, you know, 5-6 years, where I'm really understanding what the conditions are. And how to bring a different kind of consciousness to those situations, and then, you know, look at it, like, be critical of it, what worked, what didn't, reflect things with my collaborators, like, adjust and see if I can do better. And so I think that's what I'm really invested in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You, I think that's a great point about stepping into the privilege, and I can't help but ask, you know, now, as you alluded to, how much that has come into light. You know, what do you have any, what are your thoughts around, I don't know, for lack of a better word, advice to people? Just because, you know, as you are well aware, on social media, people are listing numbers to call, you know, and representatives to contact and, you know, what have you, maybe petitions to sign. But what is maybe a more personalized process to respond to the moment that starts maybe with stepping into your privilege, you know, and then what is the next step in a general sense?
Well, I think that the examples that you cite are instances where someone's made a suggestion and people are crying out for ways to be mobilized,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think I think it's a multiple front. We need to apply pressure to multiple parts of this hegemony. But I do think on a personal level, what we have some control over is the ways in which we begin to decolonize our minds. And I think there is a lot of, in the Black radical tradition and Black Atlantic intellectual thought, as well as the history of freedom struggle and movements across the globe, a tremendous amount of knowledge. And people need to study up. And it's not enough to just know who did what and why they were significant, but to begin to position oneself in relationship to larger systems of inequity.
Mm-hmm.
So what privilege do you have? What are you willing to give up? what wrongs are happening, and like how do you right them? So for example, like I hire people. Okay? Like I inherited a department full of 10 lovely white men. And then I had, let's say, you know, 5 positions to fill. And I thought, okay, whose voice isn't here who I need? Whose voice do I need here? Whose voices do my students need here? And then how does the desire to have plurality and inclusivity really support the environment? You know, how do I make the best department possible? And so I think it's sort of like that, again, is not something that I was able to do 5 years ago. But now, you know, in owning the power, in making a conscious decision, you know, on that level, you know, I bring in, you know, just a bunch of new voices and visions. And I think so it's sort of like everybody at some point or another is faced with a decision that they can make that can have impact in that way. And what's more, if you've been training your whole life to try to really be a major player in your field, you're likely already in that situation. And it's just a question of looking around and taking stock and seeing where there are places where you can have impact for collective liberation.
Yeah. Wow. That's heavy.
I mean, so we make changes in curriculum. We make changes in whose bodies are in the building. We talk about gender and craft and labor. Mm-hmm. We talk about, like, you know, whiteness. We talk about white supremacy. Mm-hmm. We talk about all of these things. And we talk about welding, right? But, mm-hmm. like, gender and welding, they're bedfellows.
Right, right.
How is welding gendered? You begin, you're planting these seeds, and these are the seeds of decolonization.
So where do we go from here?
I don't know. Let's see, we covered where the beginning, sort of. I mean, we covered where we are now. I mean, how's our time?
Our time is good. We still have time. You know, I just got a little stuck in my tracks there, so I thought I would see if there was anywhere you wanted to go.
I mean, I think that we hit all the things that that I feel are most pressing. I mean,
right.
You're great at this too.
Oh, you're too kind. I feel like you're kicking my ass, which I appreciate because usually it's so easy. well, let's talk about where you are now, because we did talk about it in a sort of general sense. But so you were at Tyler. How would you categorize Tyler as either generally as a, you know, as a the reputation of the style of program, and maybe more specifically what it was like when you were there, and then in turn, you know, RISD right now and what you're bringing to the table?
Well, so I was in the painting, drawing, and sculpture department. I mean, I think that, you know, it was a time of major transition. I mean, you have those moments in academia where, you know, you'll have a set of retiring faculty, and that will completely change the tenor. So Jude Talashay and Margot Margolis both retired. So I couldn't really speak to what the new culture of the department is like.
Mm-hmm.
There are tremendous people working at Tyler, though. Jesse Harrod is running the Fiber Material Studies Department, and she cut her teeth in Chicago at SAIC, and now is just, you know, unbelievable. Talk about, like, you know, a political sort of, like, jewel.
Mm-hmm.
Pepo Nazario is in the community arts an art education wing of the school. And, you know, he comes through painting, drawing, and sculpture. He comes through fiber and material studies. I mean, I think, like, those departments are really, really strong. And I think at Tyler, like, you know, it used to be, like, a different scenario for that school where, you know, the state of Pennsylvania really had more funding. The tuition was way lower. So now it's really just expensive. It's expensive, and it used to be really like a deal.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was free, and you got to ride around on a forklift.
Right.
So it was kind of like there was a real moment when a certain kind of class diversity, and then hence, you know, gender and race diversity was happening. And I think it's sort of like that's how the place looked. On the inside, I think higher ed in general is at a very important moment, and it's one where we can really, you know, get involved in charting the course here for how do we not just train people who are going to be like the next artists, but how do we train people that have vision and understand how to push their gifts out into the world to affect the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's like, what's at stake now? And what's been at stake? I mean, to be honest, like, you know, a movement, the freedom movement's been on for hundreds and hundreds of years. So where we are in terms of the responsibility of training artists to put out critically literate artwork into the world, like we have a chance now.
Yeah.
And I think people are really feeling that. And I saw those efforts underway at Tyler, you know, while I was on faculty and was part of them. And it was really joyful work, really difficult work. You know, it was a lot of political work, a lot of trying to convince people that things needed to change. But I know that people are understanding that more and more.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's going on there. And so it's exciting. And I mean, there's a lot of work ahead for everybody at all schools.
Yeah.
But I can say for sure that there's a lot of really compelling work underway there. Trainings, faculty trainings, like student protests, mm-hmm. student artwork. I mean, we had them at RISD too. And those are the moments when you're like, this is what the students need from us.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just sit down and take some notes.
Yeah, what you're describing is sounding a lot like as much as we need to train thoughtful and critically making artists who make critically thought out work, we need to make citizens of the world and active citizens of the world.
Yeah. And I mean, if you have gifts with moving images and you understand how to deal with representation, oh man, could we use some help?
Mm.
If you understand narrative, oh my God, what stories are we telling? Like what stories have yet to be told? What stories need to be told? I mean, so it's sort of like there's really a lot of power in this. And I mean, you know, Stuart Hall and Bell Hooks, like, you know, if anybody wants to just put that in the Googler, Stuart Hall, and pull up a video on YouTube, you can really learn a lot about the ways in which certain bodies are described in Hollywood films, in mass media. And, you know, it's my students who go get those jobs. So if they don't understand what they're doing and how they're repeating racist motifs, sexist motifs, homophobic motifs, then I haven't done my job.
Mm-hmm. Was Tyler? What percentage of Tyler was faculty was coming from New York, say, versus more locally? Would you say?
In the painting department, it was about half and half.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
I would say, yeah. Five and five.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm trying to ask about Philadelphia as far as, you know, being a commuter art community or, you know, to where it is as far as its identity as an art community being so close to New York and that, you know, people would just want to go to New York if they were that close or vice versa.
I mean, Philly is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Philly is, like, what you get in Philly is the ability, probably what you had in New York in the 70s, where you can afford to work, you know, three-quarter, let's say part-time to full-time, anywhere in that spectrum. You can afford your studio. You can get together with a bunch of your friends and rent a space. You can have an artist-run space. There are tons of artist-run spaces. You can get a show. You can talk to a gallery director. You can work at a museum and come up through the ranks and then show at that museum. So I think it's a community that really cares about its artists. And I think that the schools really care about the students. And I think that it's just an experiment as what happens in that situation. I know that LA functions that way, but there's a market there. So if there's no market, what's possible? And I think that there's a ton that's possible. And it's weird. It's interesting. I mean, yeah, I mean, I love it. I love Philly.
It hasn't come up in the conversations that I've had around, you know, where people are going to, you know, like there's always, with New York, there's always the conversation of where are people going to go, you know, in the migration out because it's too expensive. And it usually, you know, the West Coast often comes up, you know, there was even Detroit at one point. But Philadelphia didn't seem to be one of those places, and that the way you're describing it should be. So maybe,
well,
maybe it is.
Hang on though, because I really don't want Philly to become a fifth borough for like unthinking white hipsters. Okay. Because that produces displacement. And I think that that's a lot of what's going on in Philadelphia, is displacement.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's sort of like when we think about like urban centers, and what role artists play. I mean, here's another place where we really need to school up. Because if I don't understand that by virtue of moving into a neighborhood, you know, that's full of, let's say, you know, first generation Americans, you know, black folks, brown folks, you know, who are renting, I'm driving their rent up,
right,
by virtue of my white body. I bring the coffee shop,
right?
And then the rents go up. And I think it's like artists need to understand like the problems with that, and that they shouldn't do it, and that there is a community there. Even if it's not visible, you know, even if there is no coffee shop, there's a community. There are stakeholders in that community. There are block captains in that community. And so I think it's sort of like where one rents and where one buys is exceedingly important, and that people need to think about like what they're looking at, even if they don't understand something to be a neighborhood in their mind. It's a neighborhood.
Yeah.
Like there are people there.
Yeah.
Like who are connected and have been for years. And so I think like that's another place where, you know, we can really educate young artists, and we need to educate ourselves, because, you know, we see the effects of it in New York. You know, everybody's like, oh, I'm getting pushed out of my neighborhood. I'm like, and you pushed tons of people out 20 years ago.
We need
to
educate.
It's sort of like how to resist this.
We need to educate mid-career artists and perhaps even older artists, as well as younger artists.
Everybody needs
I'll let you share your whatever words of wisdom you might have for an artist who's been on the show in the past, who informed me that he bought a building in this very brown neighborhood east of downtown not long ago, and has kicked out a couple of tenants. So what do you say to that? That's not the right way to go, obviously, but anything else?
I mean, I don't know the person, and I don't know the circumstances, but I think, like, in some ways, the damage is done. But I think it's sort of like having some sense of, like, responsibility and, like, stewardship and solidarity, like getting to know the people that are living in your building.
Yeah.
And not seeing everything just according to the bottom line. But, I mean, of course, like, we are all subjects of capitalism. But if we can begin to have a conversation about, you know, the pressures I'm sure your former guest feels to make an investment lucrative, mm-hmm, is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of like within those constraints, if we're really going to say, like, if we're really going to let ourselves be thrown about this way, I mean, maybe it would have made more sense for him to take on less debt and think about it as a cooperative, or think about it as, you know,
right,
a collective building.
Right.
So it's sort of like when you're the one who's taking on the lion's share of financial responsibility, it can cause people to do some pretty egregious things.
Yeah.
That they maybe didn't see themselves doing. But I think it's like, you know, if before you think about, like, how do you assemble capital? You know, how are you going to make that happen for the down payment? There are probably tons of ways that it didn't have to be such high stakes, mm-hmm, that then you're acting mercenary and pushing people out onto the street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't know who talks about those models. So I like talking about those models, or just positing the idea that there could have been, and maybe still is, another way to do business.
Right. And being that you've moved into Providence from New York, what has been your approach in that regard?
Well, I bought into like a condo building that like was a condo since 2008. So it's an old mill building that is gentrified, you know, like, and I live in Central Falls, and it's sort of like, you know, this weird outcropping of people who always wanted to live in lofts. Although there are still laws that say on the books that I can make noise and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm one of the few artists here. I'm in a yuppie building. I'm where I belong, right? Like, in terms of my income bracket.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's sort of like, you know, maybe if people would just, like, realize that, you know, go buy into the place that's, like, already been colonized. Don't go colonize another neighborhood. And think about it in terms of, do I really want to be a settler colonialist in my approach to, like, real estate in my town?
Yeah. No.
Yeah. And then, you know, but also, like, think about, like, keeping your kids in public schools if you're a white body?
Right.
You know, because like if white folks are on, you know, the PTA board and on school boards, like they can argue for resources. When people divest from public schools, you know, then you lose a certain, you know, level of bureaucratic literacy and advocates. And then the public schools become crappy.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's just sort of like, look, you know, so like it. I know that there's this big push to sort of like privatize and individualize and all that sort of stuff, but we do for, I don't know how much longer, have some sort of commons, but the commons, people have been divesting in the commons. We've been divesting in this notion of we.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's sort of like, if we begin to think a little bit about, well, what's good for us, you know, I mean, you just look at like, you know, what's happening with the Sioux at Standing Rock. And it's just kind of like, you know, there's like a regime that wants to like poison water.
Yeah.
And it's their water and it's our water and it's drinking water, for Christ's sake, right? So it's like, all right, there's an instance where we is really clear.
Yeah.
We all need to drink water.
Yeah.
But it's like maybe there are other instances where it's not as clear. So sitting down and being like, okay, like what are actually the ramifications for my community, my world, my family, you know, my heart, like in this transaction.
Yeah. Right.
And making those like popular points of conversation so that we can get to the bottom of why we act the way we act.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Lisa, you have said a lot of, very thought provoking and thoughtful things, and, yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you for talking.
Thanks, Michael.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You got it right out. You're fantastic at this. I do this anytime.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. Well, we will hopefully get some feedback and maybe we'll have you back and maybe for a more specific angle, but we'll see what happens. And we're out. Thank you again to Lisa Raskin for talking to me, talking to us, offering some inspiring and thoughtful insights about gentrification, art making, and so much more. And about that person we talked about who's gentrifying around here, bought the building and all, I did make a reference to that maybe about 4 or 5 episodes ago. I think the Jen Dalton episode, actually. So if you want to get a little more insight, I'm trying to be discreet about it, understandably. So FYI, that's where you go. Meantime, wanted to remind you this is a listener-supported show. That means your support of this show keeps it going. If you go to theconversationpod.com/support, you can support the show a couple of ways. Financially, you can donate through PayPal, and I'm grateful for a recent donation from a San Francisco listener who preferred to remain anonymous, but it was the first one in quite a while. I set up the Patreon, which is another way you can donate, page fairly recently, and that's a way that you can donate on an ongoing basis for as little as $1 a month. So it could be something that you barely notice. And I do want to put a little more emphasis on the donations this week, just because I am honestly considering dropping down to maybe every other week. On the other hand, if I get a little more support financially, it will help make things more feasible to keep going at a week. And I would really hate to disappoint the hardcore fans and supporters of the show who really do support both financially and morally the enterprise. So I would hate to disappoint them by dropping down to twice a month, once every other week. So you guys, the rest of you, if you haven't supported the show yet financially, would really appreciate you stepping up at this time. So thank you very much in advance. You can also support the show by becoming a follower on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. Become a fan on Facebook, and would really also appreciate it if you guys can help more people find the show, not only through word of mouth, but if you could just take 2 minutes, click on the link to iTunes, which is, I believe, on the About page of the show. You can just write a quick review. You don't even really have to say much. If you just give us 5 stars, 5 out of 5 stars, that will really help. The more 5-star ratings that one has on iTunes, the more people that ultimately find the show. So that would be greatly appreciated. All right. Enough patter and requesting. The article I wanted to tell you about is by Arianna Huffington, she of the Huffington Post. It's called How to Get Out of the Cycle of Outrage in a Trump World. And I will link to that on the website in the description of this episode. But basically, it's about how the more that we give in to the outrage and complain about how shitty things are, the more satisfying the Orange Julius Caesar becomes, in a sense. It's a lot more detailed than that, and if you read it, you will get all of the nuances of it. But I wanted to at least bring your attention to it and let you know that if you scroll down to the bottom of it, there are several different ways that you can act that are actually tangible things you can do that are calls to action. There's 5 calls you can make in 5 minutes. There's the resistance manual. There's run for something. There's no one left behind. The march for science and so on. So a bunch of resources there that are helpful as well. So go check that out. It's linked through the website, How to Get Out of the Cycle of Outrage in a Trump World. And thank you guys so much for being here. Thank you for listening. And speaking of this subject, I'm actually going to be speaking live in the studio again with an artist who has been very active in protests and organizing and whatnot. So it'd be interesting to get her take on things. So that's coming up, not next week, but probably in a couple weeks. And again, thanks to your donations, especially you have not donated before, that will keep the show at once a week for sure. So consider that investment in the show, in the podcast. And thank you very much. And I will talk to you, I presume, next week. Ciao for now.